Hey, welcome back to the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Josh Yellen with the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program. www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. You can find us on Twitter at U of H MAT. You can catch us on the Sports Medicine Broadcast, which is really the brainchild of Jeremy Jackson over at Pasadena High School. I'm sitting here to my right is Bruce Nischwitz, and right before Bruce we had Webb Miranda. Webb's an athletic trainer with United Airlines, and he was a high school athletic trainer for a while. Bruce, thanks for being here with us.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
So, Bruce, a lot of people are unfamiliar with athletic training outside of that traditional athletic setting. And when they think about athletic trainers in other industrial settings, whether it was like at United Airlines with Webb or what you do, you're an athletic trainer with NASA. Tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Okay. Well, as an athletic trainer, I expected to be doing really just pure athletic training type work when I first got there. When I interviewed, I was pleasantly surprised that there was a lot more strength conditioning and really hands-on work with crew members in the gym as far as,
when you talk about crew members, you're talking about
the astronauts themselves. As well as the pilots that you might see flying around Houston area, those little white planes. It's the aircraft operations division, so AOD, AOD pilots. Now, a lot of the astronauts are not pilots themselves, and they have to have flight hours in aircraft, and they do different types of things in aircraft, so they need pilots to fly them around. So we have a whole other group of pilots that work at Ellington Airport or Ellicottville, and we're responsible for their care somewhat too. They will come to us if they have some sort of aches and pains.
So tell us about the team, right? So first of all, before we get into that, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you come across this opportunity? Because I'm sure there are a lot of people listening, either where they're listening live right now across the room from us, or they're tapping into the YouTube or the podcast, and they just heard Webb Miranda talk about his job over at United, and they may say, hey, you know what, I want to transition into the industrial, occupational side of athletic training. How did you get this opportunity with NASA, and do you work, who pays you? Is NASA that pays you, or do you work for another contractor?
Yeah, I work for a company called Wiley. They have been contracting with NASA for as long as I know. They've been there, obviously, many years before that. So I really didn't know that there was an athletic trainer at NASA, per se, years ago. I was working at Alvin High School. Originally, I started working for St. John Hospital in Sports Medicine, and I was assigned to Alvin High School as their athletic trainer, their clinical outreach athletic trainer. And after a number of years, that contract was ended. And the high school obviously needed somebody to be their athletic trainer. I approached them and said, hey, this is either gone or we can create some sort of position, which they were happy to do. And I worked there for another 5. So I was at the same high school for 9 years, more or less doing the same thing, athletic duties. And my wife, who I met at that school, left the teaching profession, and she had always, either wanted to be a teacher or be in some sort of NASA-related type job. It was one of her dreams, I guess. She was able to get a job there a couple years before I did. And because she was able to get that job, she met the different people and heard about the program and told me about it. I remember her specifically talking about it. And I said, they need to have athletic trainers over there taking care of those astronauts. They get a lot of training, and they have to climb in and out of that suit. And they're in that gym. Because I'd heard about that they had this astronaut. And she said, it's called the ACER group.
Yeah, what does ACER stand for?
Well, it stands for Astronaut Strength Conditioning and Rehabilitation Group.
So, and if I'm not mistaken, the NATA came down and they did a nice little article about you guys, right?
They did. They came down for a day out of Dallas, and we spent the day showing them around NASA, showing off what we there, and more or less just sitting down and chit-chatting with them and doing it.
And so what are some of the things that, obviously in when you and I were coming out of school, similar to what Webb was just sitting here talking about, similar to some other athletic trainers. When you and I were going to school, we learned all about, the prevention and the diagnosis and the rehabilitation, the immediate care of these traditional athletes. And now we're really kind of transitioning to something called occupational athlete. So what are some of the things that these astronauts are doing on a daily basis where you as an athletic trainer need to understand the biomechanics, understand, the movements, understand some of the rehabilitation activities that may be a little bit different than what you learned in the traditional settings.
Well, the main reason why we would consider national in that area of occupational medicine, and I say that there's probably one caveat, and that is some of the things that they have to deal with when they're performing their job is obviously out of this world, right? So there's zero gravity, they're on the space station.
It's literally out of this world.
So it presents a number of challenges that a normal setting, or even outside of the normal setting, would ever really have to deal with. But it's still part of their job, and they still train many hours to perform those tasks on the space station. So because they're training all those hours, whether it's in a space suit that's, you might think of as at least on Earth, it's like a submarine, or on orbit, like in a space suit, or I mean a spaceship, all those hours of training in the suit, or training in cramped quarters, or training under just strange environments, it really adds a uniqueness to my job, and I think it's outside of what I would have ever imagined having to do with athletic training. It's not contact sports, or it's not just simple overuse. They are overused, but it's specific, I guess you could say, to their environment.
So a lot of times, if I look at it from an athletic training education standpoint, we have to meet certain standards, and one of the standards is they have to be in an individual or team sport. And it has to be a sport with equipment-intensive type situations. Is there anything at NASA where it's, there's equipment-intensive that you guys have to be aware of?
I would say that the what we call the EMU, it's the Extravehicular Mobility Unit. Everything at NASA has some sort of acronym or initials, similar to the military. So that would probably be the number one thing. The EMU is the spacesuit that they have to practice wearing. In a big giant pool in the NBL, which is the Neutral Buoyancy Lab. It's, I think it's still the largest indoor swimming pool in the world. It's 40 feet, it's 100 feet wide and 200 feet long. I don't know how many gallons it is. I suppose we can do
a
some
lot.
Quick math and figure that stuff out. But so they have to climb up into this suit. It's many parts put together mainly into two main pieces. You have the heart of the torso and the sleeve and arms, and then you have the pants and boot. Basically, you slide into the legs and the boot, and they weigh probably 150 pounds.
Just the legs and the boot.
Just the legs and the boot, and you kind of have help carrying yourself around, getting to the platform, where you have to then climb up into this heart, upper torso, and sleeve.
And does that weigh about 150 pounds?
Yeah, it's about the same weight.
So they're walking around with 300 pounds of gear.
Well, not necessarily walking, but they are wearing it. Now they're bolted to a platform rack on a crane when they're going lifted into this big giant pool. So you have to climb up into this thing, and if you kind of think about how it might have been for maybe a knight back in the Middle Ages or whatever to get into a suit of armor. Similar. It's quite difficult to climb up, and your shoulders are contorted, your arms are contorted to climb up into this thing, and you kind of ease yourself in, and it can be difficult, especially for someone who has a little bit of a lack of motion. I've had to do it a number of times, just so they gave us exposure to what we experienced, and it's not the easiest thing to climb in. I had a little bit more success with it than some other folks. I just, maybe because my range of motion is different, or the way I'm built, I might fit the suit a little bit differently, but I didn't hurt myself anyway.
Right.
So,
and how many times, right, these astronauts, it sounds like, and again, for, you and I, right, work together every Monday, right? I go down there, and as part of my job with the University of Houston, I work with the ACER group, which is an incredible opportunity for me and really unique, and I really appreciate what you guys are doing down there. And, I've gone through a lot of education there. But there are a lot of people that are listening to the radio, or even people that are listening to us live right now, that they've never even thought about being an athletic trainer with NASA, and they've never really thought about these things that you're talking about. So it sounds really like you need to be able to take a lot of your education, and if we look at the new practice domains of athletic training, where prevention and wellness, protection, health promotion, it sounds like you're doing a lot of that, like Webb is doing over at United.
Yeah, I think it fits into that scenario really well. The injury prevention part probably is what David and I try and focus on the most as athletic trainers.
Now, who's David?
David Holland is another athletic trainer that I work with. He's one of the three people in my group currently.
And who's, so who's the other one?
Mark Gillings.
And is Mark also an athlete trainer?
He is not. He is a certified strength and conditioning specialist.
So you have two certified athlete trainers. And tell us a little bit about that. You both have bachelor's degrees and you both have master's degrees. Or how, if somebody is looking to try to duplicate this, what kind of education do you think they need?
I think originally NASA didn't have a whole lot of knowledge about you know, athlete trainers in general. And they, I don't want to say they weren't selective, but I think it was probably, if you had good experiences, they were willing to, you know, hey, this person is qualified. These days, with it being just a little bit more tightly controlled, I think, and just more popular, I think they're able to select people with, I think, a little bit longer experience time. So if you looked at, say, my resume to anybody else's resume, even somebody straight out of college, probably wouldn't be all that dissimilar, right? Mm-hmm. We've taken the same coursework and have similar experiences now. But I was an athletic trainer at a high school for 9 years. And
so similar to what Webb did. Webb was also a head athletic trainer at high school.
Yeah. So I don't think this type of job that I'm in now is something that we would just take somebody straight out of college. I think that it's something that you have to actually go out and get some experience doing, whether it's at a high school or at a college setting or even in some setting like what he's in with the airline or military. Something that's where you're just, you know, you're successful at what you're doing at that particular time. They're not necessarily looking for one group or one person from one area. They wanted to bring in different types of talents.
That's not necessarily a prototype.
Exactly. There's no prototype for what we do. It's just that as a unit, as one unit, we're a couple different parts. And those parts still got their experience from someplace else.
Right.
So it's not something you can move right into.
It's really interesting, you know, in the athletic training world, you have a lot of people that, you know, you are trained in a specific setting, and for a lot of people it's hard to move outside of that box of comfort. And it sounds like you took that specific training and then you moved your box and got outside that comfort zone and applied it.
Yeah. People have said, oh, you know, Bruce, you're so gutsy, you take these chances. And I was raised in Ohio. I went to Kent State University, went to the graduate assistant position in Mankato, Minnesota, and I didn't know a soul there. And they, you know, I can't believe you're leaving. You're just moving off, and you're just going and doing whatever. And it's like, well, I'm going to go to school. I'm going to go to graduate school. It's like, I'm not going forever. Mine's only a 2-year position, and who knows what's going to happen after that. So, who knows what happened is that I had nothing going on after graduate school. I'm like, what am I going to do? I got to find a job. Everybody was either turning me down or wasn't really paying attention to my resume that looked just like every other postgraduate person.
So everybody that's coming out of school has got the same, essentially, experiences and qualifications and education.
Yeah, you know, I've had to do some hiring on my own from when I was, you know, at high school, and it's some are, well, I know I don't necessarily want this person, they just don't meet the qualification. But it's amazing how many look identical. And when you start talking to people, it's even more so.
So you go back to a unique concept and something that we tell, you know, students all the time. And this is something that Jasmine and I, right? Jasmine, you and I had this conversation. What's going to separate you from the rest of the pack, right? Everybody's going through this education.
Yeah.
Everybody's got all the same coursework in the same order. And now, obviously, with the new CAVI standards, and everybody's doing the same thing. So what's really going to separate the student, you know, from the pack?
Yeah, I don't know that I even had anything on my resume that separated me other than years later I had the experience. But I think that if I was to talk to a student now, I would say take some chances and go outside of the box for sure. Don't be afraid to move away from, you know, like I said, I moved from Ohio to Minnesota without knowing anybody. When I came down to Texas, I only knew just a couple of people in the state, and it's a big state.
Yeah, it's the size of 5 states.
Yeah. Unless you live in Alaska, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't know anybody in the Houston area, really. I knew family in Katy, but I didn't know anybody in this profession. And my closest friend in this profession was over in Copper Cove, which is on the west side of Fort Hood. So that's many hours away. He was instrumental in getting me down here. But it wasn't like I could just call him up and we could go grab a burger. You know, it was
because you lived 10 hours away.
Yeah, I mean, I lived way over here in Houston. So, you know, coming down here was obviously what was supposed to be for me. It was nothing that I ever thought would ever happen. I never expected to leave the Midwest.
Right.
But it happened, and I enjoyed here. I've been here since 1997.
So you've been in Houston since 1997, and 9 years of that you spent
at Alvin.
So that was up until 2006. And then after 2006, after you leave the high school athletic trainer, so let's back up, right? You come out of undergraduate in Kent State.
Yeah, 95.
Then you go on to be a graduate assistant at
Mankato State.
Mankato State in Minnesota.
Minnesota State.
Yeah, and you leave there in what year?
97.
You leave there in 97, yeah. And then you come down here in 97.
Yeah, Kathy Shupak, which some people might know her around here, she worked at Clear Brook, very active in the Texas State organization. She is a Southwest Texas State. My friend Dan went to graduate school there. He and I went to undergraduate. He was working at Cop Dakota High School. It's WADA. They live in Munchen. He shares an elevator with her. He overhears her talking to another colleague. Man, I got to fill this position down there in Clear Lake. I have a high school job through St. John. He says, I can have him down. I can have somebody there in a week, just out of the blue, you know.
So again, it goes back to something that Webb and I were talking about, right? So, you know, that kind of Kevin Bacon 6 or 7 degrees of separation.
Yeah.
So here's a situation where, you're in an elevator, and he goes out on a limb for you.
I wasn't there. I was actually up in Minnesota.
Right. So, but he's in the elevator, right? He goes out on a limb for you, and, you know, you don't necessarily know Kathy, but through this relationship, he says, hey, I've got somebody for you. And you know what? If you hadn't done a good job all those other years, he'd look like a moron. But he doesn't, right? You come down and you're there for 9 years.
Yeah. He said, oh, I can have somebody here, in a week if that's what you need. She says, well, do you have your resume? No, but I can get it to you within an hour. I just have to make a phone call. Mm-hmm. So he wakes me up probably. No, but I'm kidding. He gives me a call. I send it down. That was fax day back then. That was not the email.
Jasmine, have you ever seen a fax machine before? You have. In the Smithsonian, is that?
So he says, you got to fax this stuff down there. I did. They called me, asked me for an interview. That was Rick Carboni. He used to be the director of the sports medicine group over at St. John. And they offered me a position. So I was the outreach athletic trainer for 5 years in St. John. Back then, I only let them go to high school.
So you're there for another 4 years.
Another 5 years.
And then after that, you leave the high school setting.
Yeah,
and
my
you
wife
go
said,
to...
hey, there's a position open at NASA, right? We had heard, we had talked to each other about this group. She says, well, I had met Mitzi Laughlin at GCAT's Christmas.
Let's back up. For those that don't know, Mitzi is our current SWATA president, and she works with me at the University of Houston. She's a research professor, and then she's also got...
She used to be an ACER. And she was our manager. And, I just happened to go to that GHATS Christmas dinner at Rice. And, my wife said, hey, that's Mitzi. She works for that group. So, she basically introduced me. It's amazing. My wife did all this for me. Not that we don't get along, but she's not an athlete in it, right? So, introduced myself to Mitzi. Hey, it'd really be neat to get involved with something like that.
Yeah,
she
sure.
says, well, we don't have any openings right now, but, keep us in mind. So I did, and when an opening came up, my wife shared enough, hey, there's an opening if you want, you should be in for it. I looked at it like, it's NASA. They're probably not looking for just some guy that's at high school. They probably want someone specific experience. But the worst I can say is no, right? So I got my resume together, submitted, got an interview. They hired myself and David alone, and they were looking for two people.
Right.
David came from a college setting, I came from a high school setting, and we're both still there.
So it sounds like all of your experiences led up to this one specific opportunity, in that you're really able to take these different domains of athletic training, prevention, health, wellness protection. And then how much immediate care in your setting, we spoke to Webb, and it sounds like he's really out in the area, and he's going to visit these people that work for United. And he's got a little bit more immediate care, I think. But tell us about the immediate care of astronauts, because I'm sure people are thinking, okay, they're up on space station floating around. Tell us some of the things that you deal with on the immediate care side.
Well, it's good. It's really tough to tape an ankle on orbit, but it's not as hard as making gator.
Right.
Because the powder just goes everywhere.
Yeah, that's right.
No, we don't see a lot of acute injuries per se. Now we'll have something that maybe will happen. Somebody gets banged up or cut up somehow, or some in some other training area. But we have a whole flight medicine clinic that they're supposed to report to for all those types of things. And we have a supply of doctors that we care. We have a full staff. So we don't have to deal with that type of acute care like I used to do at high school. I'm putting bands on people, right? And taping up ankles and that. But you do have the occasional blister that somebody might develop. And we have a, you know, a full athletic training room right there where they do their exercise. And they can go out running. Hey, can you take a look at my foot? I think developed a blister. Or, hey, I kind of jerked the wrist of my foot.
So you're really doing a lot of prevention and health promotion. You're doing a lot of, you know, some immediate care, but you're doing a lot of rehabilitation. You're doing some.
Yeah, it's mainly the post injury send us from, you know, from the doctor if they come to us,
right.
Or they come to us and then we evaluate them, send them to one of our doctors. They turn back to us for a full cap.
So now let's transition from the astronaut here on Earth, right, and then they go up in this little rocket,
big rocket,
and they take off. And how fast are they going?
They reach 17,500 miles per hour.
So they're moving about, it's Mach 25. So you're moving 17,500, and how long are they in that position for, to get to the space station?
It used to be like 2 days they'd be stuck in that tin can, but now it's like four or five hour ride
going to Mach 25.
Yeah, not at first, obviously. But
yeah, you got to overcome all that thrust, right? And so then they dock to space station. How long are they up there for?
They're up there between 5.5 to 6 months.
And so I'm sure a lot of people that know anything about physiology are thinking, boy, you're not in a gravity-dependent situation. There's got to be a bunch of bone loss. Tell us about some of the stuff that goes on in your interaction with the astronauts who are up on station.
Speaking of bone loss, because of this microgravity or zero gravity, they start losing bone loss as soon as they start to pull away from the Earth's orbit. And obviously, it's not like you feel the switch go off. Oh my gosh, I'm losing bone. But it slowly starts to go away. And in the, you know, the days prior to the days of today, where we have the equipment that we have up there, some equipment that was just not as capable, we would see losses of 1% a month, which is much, much higher than we see as far as hospital
losses. Right.
So it's real important for an active crew member that's going to be launched or preparing for that flight to build as much bone mineral density as they can prior to that. So that becomes even more reason to stay active and fit, to do lots of weight training,
right,
because it's really the best way to put on bone.
And so when they're on station, right, and describe to some of the listeners if you can, you take off on this rocket and you bring a couple 25-pound dumbbells with you, what happens?
Yeah, it's one of the ones that you can put the pins in and give you the mark.
Yeah.
Now, they have three devices on orbit. They have a cycle ergometer. We call it CVIS. Again, it's crazy NASA stuff. Yeah. Cycle ergometer with vibration and isolation and stabilization.
Okay.
That's a mouthful. So CVIS. CVIS is just a basic cycle. It's in our pedal on it. It doesn't have handlebars. It's attached to a big steel rack, aluminum probably rack actually, that has these little shock absorbers on it, bounce around like a Buffy Bronco. You have to learn how to ride it.
Uh-huh.
It's probably really tough to ride. But they ride it at least every other day probably. That their protocols are established between work with our group as well as the exercise lab that does the VO2 max test and all. And we develop maybe 5 or 6 rides that they do that change wattage.
Okay.
The treadmill is the second generation treadmill.
So what's that called?
We just call it T2.
Treadmill 2.
Treadmill 2, yeah. The first one was called TVIS. Yeah, treadmill.
So you had CVIS and then you had TVIS.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, T and then VIS. So yeah. The VIS is the vibration and isolation and stabilization. So it's the second generation treadmill. It's a wood weight based treadmill. Wood weight, a good product. It's a good off the shelf company. So that treadmill is been kind of tweaked by NASA. It has an additional motor that can go in reverse. I shouldn't say reverse. It resists the belt.
I understand.
Shouldn't say reverse. Not that it spins in reverse, but it also has little force plates in it that can measure load, impact loads, and stuff like that. So the exercise physiology people can get a lot of data, and we can design programs really any way we like to on it on device.
And then talk a little bit about the weights. You know, we said when the astronauts are packing up to go up to space, they throw in a couple of the 25-pound weights to go back.
Yeah. So now we have our weight training device or our resistive exercise device, ARED, which is the advanced resistive exercise device. And it works. It's a pretty big device. It's very robust. basically the resistance comes from vacuum to vacuum cylinders. Mm-hmm. They supply three.
Similar to like a syringe plunger almost.
Yeah, if you think about it in that manner, maybe a, yeah, I guess a syringe plunger would probably be the way you describe it. Two of those canisters supply constant load of 300 resistance. Now, that piston on the syringe is connected to anyway, it's connected to the loading LAU.
Okay.
Load adjustment. So it's all this NASA stuff.
I understand. Anyway, my first day there, I didn't understand anything, including how to get to where you were.
Yeah.
And I almost got kicked out by the NASA police.
Well, to think about the way the load is if you think about that piston on the plunger, if it's connected to, say, a teeter-totter, depending on where you connect that piston to the teeter-totter, because it's a lever system,
sure,
will increase or decrease that load based on mechanical advantage. So
sure,
we can crank a dial towards the fulcrum or away from the fulcrum. We should say move the fulcrum towards the center or further away. So that's how we adjust the load. Mm-hmm. But it's a constant load of 300 pounds. Mm-hmm.
So 300 pounds, so 600 pounds total. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah, it is a lot. We have really strong action.
Yeah.
Now, we have to compensate for body weight because we're in microgravity or zero gravity. Our body weight is obviously not felt. We're always carrying it on Earth, so we have to add that back into anything that we lift.
If somebody weighs 200 pounds and they're lifting 300 pounds,
yeah,
you have to compensate for 500 pounds.
Yeah, we don't use the full 500, but because of such a large percentage of your body weight is below the waist, and if you're doing lifts that are, say, leg dominant,
right,
like triple extension lifts, period, deadlifts or squats or something like that, we will add the weight back. We don't add the same percentage of every lift. If they're carrying the weight on their shoulders like a squat or a heel raise or something like that, we usually go around 70%. If it's a deadlift, the ratio is 45.
So let's go back, right? We've got CVIS, we've got TVIS, and we've got ARED. Mm-hmm. And these got T2. Yeah, T2. And so you've got CVIS, T2, and ARED. And so you have an astronaut that's up there, and this guy's a real, you know, we'll call it a gym rat.
Okay.
And so that astronaut's up there, and he's working out 8 hours a day, or are there specific things? Because really, it's really interesting, right? Because if on Earth, if we have a patient that needs to contact us, they'll contact us on cell phone and ask a couple questions. So this astronaut is going to be able to talk to you from space. How do they talk to you, and how long are they really doing some of these protocols for?
Well, they can contact us by phone if they need to. We've had probably a crew member per increment probably call their ACER specifically and talk to them.
So let me get this straight. You're out to dinner with maybe some families or friends. The phone rings, and you say, I'm sorry, I've got to take this space.
I'm sorry, exactly. This is space calling. So it's happened. The worst is when they tell you in an email or in your video conference that we have once a week, hey, I'm going to give you a call, talk to you about such and such, so be aware. Maybe they're going to call you on your birthday or something like that, and then you miss it, you know.
Oh, yeah.
On your pocket or something.
I'm sure that's her, you know, if like you're in a meeting or something and the phone rings, I mean, that's a real, sorry, I've got to take this. What's so important? Actually, it's space.
It's happened, yeah. I was in a meeting one time, and we were talking about that specific person because they were a sprint subject, and that's one of the payloads that's going to go. It's one of the science experiments that's going on. So they were talking about that specific person. I said, excuse me, this is this person on the phone.
Calling from space.
Hey, how you doing? Okay, we're not talking about you.
That's pretty good cell reception.
Yeah, you know, I have Verizon.
So if anybody's from Verizon, they're looking. That's a little plug for Verizon. Yeah, can you hear me now? Yes, I can hear you from space.
So, they'll call you from space. But we have email capabilities, and we have a video conference. It's scheduled through once a week contact them through the flight medicine people. So
it sounds like you're able to talk to the astronauts just like any other athlete trainer would be able to talk to their patient.
Yeah.
Just what you do is a little bit different. Similar to, you know, when Webb was here and was talking about what he does for United, you're taking a lot of skills that you learn as a clinical athletic trainer, and you're applying them and you're adjusting them.
Yeah.
And you're applying them to, you know, the NASA setup.
Yeah, I wish I could just pick up the phone and call them when I have a quick question to ask. Unfortunately, I have to email it or wait until the following week to ask that question. But usually we do it through email. They're pretty quick to get back to us.
Do they ever text message you? Did they ever take a selfie of themselves and send it to you?
I've gotten many selfies from those guys. You know, they take these little pictures inside the cupola with the Earth. The cupola is like, think of it as a big bay window.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Looking out towards Earth, and you see them floating there, and you know, they have this picture aimed towards them. they must be having a life of it.
So I think it was the April edition of the NATA News, right? It comes out with a nice nice cover story about the Acers, and then I was fortunate enough to get a little bottom section about our new program and our interaction. You know, the
Josh, direction. That was what everybody asked me about.
What's
like,
that?
They were saying, "Hey, you know, I see you got that article. Who's this Josh guy that you're asking?"
I don't think so. and then this last cover is another astronaut.
Yeah, Mark Kelly.
Mark Kelly, and you know, I read the article. Thanks to you pointed it out. I hadn't had a chance to read it, but I got it and I opened it and I read it. And sure enough.
Yeah,
he plugs athletic training.
He will be the keynote speaker at the NATA convention in Indianapolis here in this 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, I think it's 2 weeks. Yeah.
So I talked to him last Friday. As a matter of fact, he was at the Johnson Space Center, and I thanked him personally for what he said about our profession and his support. Guy, thank you. You're welcome. Kind of don't remember exactly what I said, but you say it was good. Yes, it was.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. I read it. I was really appreciative of it. And I think that you and David and Mark over there, I think you all are doing a great job. Again, I only get to really interact with you guys on Mondays, but you have such a unique job. And I think that, you know, the exposure of the three of you has really led to a lot of questions, at least from the athletic training education side, that when I have people apply the program, they go, hey, you know, I saw this article, I heard about it. And now you've really got the cover story of you guys in April, and now the cover story of Mark. So there are two promotions for athletic training in these non-traditional settings. They're really promoting what you're doing.
Yeah, I've been we've been fortunate, I think, past, obviously. This is one of the goals that I had a couple of years ago, and Dr. Greg Shashkin was involved in that. Unfortunately, he passed away. But when he sat down, he said, you know, what kind of things do you want to approach? And we, you know, obviously the stuff that was directly related to our work was on the list. And what about the outside of the box stuff? Or what about, you know, just promoting the group in general? And I remember saying specifically, I think it would be NATA with the storehouse. And so that was put on the back burner for quite a while. But it came up, we did it, and glad to be involved in it.
Yeah, it's good. A couple last questions here for you, Bruce. If obviously you and I have had some private conversations about athletic training education, and I seem to get a lot of those questions all the time, that when they find out this is an entry-level master's, everybody seems to have an opinion about what we're doing right or what we're doing wrong or what should change, what shouldn't change. If you were going to give some advice to a student, whether they're coming out of an undergraduate athletic training program or a graduate athletic training program, even a post-professional master's, what's some of the advice that you would give to somebody that's thinking, you know what, I don't really want to be in the traditional setting. I really like what Bruce is doing. I really like what Webb is doing. How do I get into something like that? What's a piece of advice? And then, you know, from the athletic training education side, if you were to give me a piece of advice of how do I make some of these students more valuable in what they can do? So first question is, what's your advice to the students? The second question is, what's your advice to me?
Okay. Well, the first, according to the, or as far as the students go, I would tell them, number one, you have to get experiences in different areas, just like the website. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go into a totally different profession. It just means you just need to get some. One of the things that I was involved with indirectly and accidentally was there were some kids that out in high school that did rodeo. Mm-hmm. Funny story with that, we had a kid that was a JV type guy, and says, you know, he's coming in, he's always banged up, and I'm watching him practice, and he's more or less standing in practice. How do you keep getting hurt? Well, I'm hurt. Well, what are you doing? You know, are you playing some kind of club thing? No. And it turns out, you know, he finally tells me, well, I'm a bull rider, because I've been kind of hammering this kid. There's no way you can get hurt all the time if you're not doing it. You can practice. I'm watching. Finally tells me, bull ride. Oh, well, why didn't you just tell me that in the first place, right? Those things are going to hurt you. They're trying to kill you. Mm-hmm. So after I told him he was nuts, I took care of him. So I started, exploring the whole rodeo thing a little bit more. I never really worked with rodeo other than some of the kids that came to me. And mm-hmm. Just learn a little bit more about it. Now, I wouldn't call that the same type of experience that obviously the Justin Sports Medicine will work with.
Right.
But you still see things from a different perspective.
Sure.
And when they explain all these different techniques that they have to do to you know, grip the hang or where they, you know, how they got flipped off of it or whatever the case may be, it just gives you a little bit different idea of what they're doing. I think that kind of stuff, be open to different avenues. So, and I think you have to be able to travel. I mean, as far as, you know, you might have to move away from home. You need to get some.
So you're really kind of hovering on that theme of, you know, you got to get outside the box.
Yeah, you got to get away from the comfort zone.
And then from an athletic training
education,
you got to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And then from an athletic training education side, you and I have had some conversations privately, but I'm interested, right? So to say, how do I better prepare, right? Because you know you've got some experience. You were at the college level, you were, you know, at Mankato State, and then you were at the outreach level, and then you were at the high school, you know, direct high school, and now you're in the industrial side. So from an athletic training education standpoint, both for my knowledge and the knowledge of all the other program directors out there, what's one thing you think that we need to know to make these students more successful?
Yeah, I at Kent State, I was in an internship.
Yeah.
Now, some people would look at the internship route from years ago and say, no, they were slaves, they were just cheated, which in many cases, it was true. You know, there was probably schools out there that just used those kids to get water to the athlete. I feel that where I was, they were honestly trying to prepare me for the profession. There was only about 8 to 10 of us. So we had a lot of work to do, and it's Division I school, right? It's a lower level of Division I, right? It's math, but we still had a number of sports. We were still catering to the same type of athlete, we just weren't easy. So those experiences were tremendous. They were crushing as far as the amount of time.
Right.
And you had to put in so much time.
Right.
If you can somehow extrapolate those types of experiences and the sheer amount of experience that we got hands-on to the students that are in these modern-day curriculums, I think it's just.
So it sounds like we really need to find a fine balance.
Yeah,
theoretical knowledge and clinical knowledge.
And that was exactly what I said when they first started talking about going away from internship route and going through just all the curriculum. Mm-hmm. So we're going to do away with the internship routes. And there was a lot of old-timer interns. Oh, you do that? That's just a horrible idea. These kids are not good. It didn't turn out to be that way.
Right.
I didn't think that it was necessarily a bad idea to do away with it, as long as you somehow kept the, you know, what the value, the most valuable part of what it was, which was the true hands.
Yeah, that clinical experience. Well, I'm glad you said this, because one of the things that I really looked at in this program was obviously that theoretical knowledge, but by the time they come out of this program, they're going to have, you know, 1,400 hours of clinical education experiences, which I think is really going to set them apart from some other programs. And the amount of diversity that they have here in Houston, who they're going to be working with, I think is really going to be a real asset to them in the program.
Yeah, there's a lot of opportunities. You have ballet, you have professional sports, you have collegiate sports, you have NASA,
we have United Airlines now.
So it's a good area to be.
Well, they're giving me the sign that I got to wrap this up. So for Bruce Nishwitz, Bruce, thank you very much. And on behalf of the Acer Group, I got to tell you again, Mondays is always a joy for me, whether it's something that we got to do. You know, whether it's hard, whether it's easy, whether it's time intensive or not, it's always a fun time down there on Monday. So I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to get down there. For the Sports Medicine Broadcast, I'm Dr. Josh Yellen with the University of Houston Master of Athletic Training Program. Again, you can find us at www.hhp.uh.edu/MAT. You can look us up on Twitter at @UofHMAT. You can catch the Sports Medicine Broadcast at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. And for Bruce Nishwitz and the Sports Medicine Broadcast, thank you very much.